You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org. There's an app for that.
His daughter, Bernice King, said that there should be no shots fired with your gun, with your words, with your fist. And I like to include my message, no violence towards anyone from conception in the womb until natural death.
Their baptism was using the same water that Jesus was using in the Jordan. It's called H2O.
The church is aware of its own blemishes and difficulties and sins, and Christ sees none of it. And that, of course, is the gospel.
Western New York State independent Baptist pastors love Issues, etc.
I cannot believe it actually has been this long. I should know, because last year was the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Tomorrow, it will be the 41st. Yet another year under our belts. The law remains. Is it as strong as it ever was in the minds of the American people? Is it understood by the American people, this law that, along with other Supreme Court decisions, this decision really, along with other Supreme Court decisions, became law of the land, legalizing abortion? And now, 41 years later, can we say in any sense that Roe's days are numbered? Or, for all intents and purposes, is it here to stay? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Tuesday afternoon, January the 21st. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Scott Klusendorf joins us, president of Life Training Institute, to reflect on 41 years of Roe v. Wade. A little bit later, Pastor Tom Baker will be teaching a Sunday school lesson here. We'll be in Matthew chapter 4, Jesus calling the first of his disciples, according to Matthew's account. A little bit later, Dr. Paul Meyer joins us. We're going to get an historian's response to an interview that we did recently with Reza Aslan, author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Reza Aslan says he's just doing a historical treatment of Jesus, and we thought, why not just bring on an historian? In fact, a professor of ancient history, to answer some of the things that Reza had to say when we were talking with him recently in our interview with him. And then Pastor Ted Giese joins us, a movie that I'd like to see. There are not a lot of them, but this one I would like very much to see. It's Nebraska. Story of a lottery winner or not, we'll get a review of that movie. Shot, by the way, entirely in black and white. Kind of makes it look cool. In the last half hour of Issues, etc. Our call-in number for the next 2 hours, 1-877-623-MY-IE. 877-623-MY-IE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at @issuesetc. Scott Klusendorf is a regular guest. He's author of the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture, and he's president of Life Training Institute. Scott, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Always good to be with you, Todd.
41 years, almost to the day after the decision that began a series of decisions legalizing abortion in the U.S., are Roe's days numbered?
Well, it depends on what you mean by Roe, and it depends on what you mean by numbered. The reason I say that is the vast majority of Americans do not even know what Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton say. Namely, what those two court cases say is that a woman may have an abortion for any reason she wants throughout all 9 months of pregnancy, practically speaking. And here's the rationale for saying that. The court argued in Roe that during the first 3 months of pregnancy, the decision is the woman's alone. During the next 3 months, the state may regulate it, but only for the safety of the mother. Only in the third trimester can any consideration be given to the unborn human, and even then it's not a requirement because the court said the state may act to protect what it called potential life, but only if those protections don't interfere with the mother's, quote, health, unquote. Then in Doe v. Bolton, the court went on to define health so broadly you can drive a Mack truck through it. So what you have is a definition of health that includes things like psychological health, family health, social health. It really goes on what the World Health Organization defined as, quote, well-being, unquote. So it's a very expansive definition of health. And by that definition of Roe and Doe, most Americans are completely ignorant. As to whether it's here to stay, I am one of those who believes that though the fight is not inevitably lost by any means, we are not as close to victory as some pro-lifers are currently proclaiming. The worldview assumptions that brought us abortion in the first place are deeply entrenched in this culture. Relativism, self-centeredness, the belief that ultimate meaning in life resides with the individual, these are not worldview assumptions that are going to go away anytime soon, and we are going to have to fight an uphill battle. But I do believe with enough time and commitment, we can win it. I'm not by any means a pessimist when it comes to ultimate victory, but I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow.
You mentioned kind of the failure of most Americans to understand the full import for the unborn of those two crucial decisions, Roe and Doe. Well, what do most Americans think Roe v. Wade and its complex of decisions actually brought about?
Well, all you have to do, Todd, is open up just about any paper from the mainstream press, whether it's a magazine or a daily paper, and you will see there Roe v. Wade represented as legalizing abortion in the first trimester. Roe v. Wade, yeah, it did legalize abortion in the first trimester, but it did a whole lot more than that. You routinely hear people in surveys misunderstand what Roe said, not only about health, but about what it says about the unborn. In fact, Francis J. Beckwith, a professor of religion and law at Baylor University, has a great point. He said in the Roe v. Wade decision, Justice Harry Blackmun said that the right to an abortion was contingent on the status of the fetus. That is, if the fetus were human, then the right to an abortion vanishes. The court then went on to say it didn't know if the unborn were human, which means, says Beckwith, the court also doesn't know if a right to an abortion exists. And that's the absurdity of this. And for most Americans, they simply haven't looked at it. And the mainstream press, of course, hasn't done its job educating them.
So are those the only reasons why that misunderstanding about Roe persists? It's been 41 years. There's been a lot of time to clear this up. And
yeah.
Roe has hardly been a subject that people don't talk about. It is a perennial subject every time we have an election, local or national. It's always looming there.
It is, and here's what's interesting. If you open law review articles, you will find that there are legal scholars favorable to abortion rights who describe Roe v. Wade as atrocious law. People like John Hart Eli, people like Archibald Cox, and others who have written that this decision reads like a hospital rule book, not something that's grounded in sound jurisprudence. Nevertheless, keep in mind, Todd, we have a culture today that is bought into the idea of judicial supremacy. We are, in many ways, no longer the republic we once were, because now you have one of the three branches exalting itself above the other two, and it leads to this strange thing where people say, I don't want the federal government involved in abortion. And whenever I hear that, I ask, do you mean the federal courts as well? Oh, no, I just don't want Congress or the states involved. They're perfectly willing to let the federal government be involved if it involves the courts, but not when it comes to their own elected voices. And so literally, one of the damaging things about Roe v. Wade is not just what it did to the unborn, but what it did to talk ordinary Americans out of the right to participate in their own government.
So let's come at that from another angle. We can hardly go back and say what if, but to what degree do you think the decision taken in 1973 has actually shaped the course of the United States in other ways by, in effect, becoming the ghost that haunts the Supreme Court every time there's a vacancy, every single time there's a vacancy?
Oh, you're absolutely right, and Roe v. Wade far from settling the abortion issue, has made it contentious. And by the way, I'm glad that it's not a settled issue, because if it were settled, I fear it wouldn't be settled in our favor. It would be settled the other way. In Europe and in some measure in Canada, it is a more settled issue than it is here. It's more contentious here. And that's a good thing, because we don't want the public to become relaxed and content with the state of abortion. We want it to be uncomfortable to them. And the Supreme Court certainly didn't do anything to settle the issue.
What are your thoughts on the strengths and the weaknesses of what's usually called the incremental approach to, like, legal remedies that attempts mm-hmm. to kind of nibble at the edges of Roe v. Wade and the other Supreme Court decisions regarding abortion? What are the strengths and weaknesses there?
Well, the strength is, in incremental legislation, you're limiting the evil done insofar as possible, given the legal and political realities in front of you. There is a very small group of pro-life advocates who would call that compromise. I do not agree with them on that. You are not compromising if you are ultimately committed to the protection of every unborn human, but you recognize you can't protect them all right now, so you act to save as many as you can to limit the evil done while you continue working for an ultimate solution. The problem we face is that the federal courts have put very strict limits on what we can do to protect unborn humans right now. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't mount frontal challenges through the courts to Roe v. Wade. We should. But we're going to have to do one of two things to turn this thing around at the court level. We're either going to have to pass a constitutional amendment, which is enormously difficult to do, or we're going to need to change the character and makeup of the federal courts, which is more doable, though it's going to take time, and this is why elections matter. It matters if you vote, because look what is done when the wrong guys get into office, when the wrong senators are approving justice nominees, when presidents are appointing nominees who are not favorable to the right to life. That has an impact on us for decades.
You have actually, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's you, you have actually debated other pro-lifers in a very cordial way, obviously, as to the issue of whether or not we should be electing only pro-life politicians and not take party into consideration. How would you summarize your thoughts there?
Well, my view is at the legislative level, Todd, the way to vote pro-life is to vote for the party most likely to advance your agenda. At the legislative level, politics is party-driven. Now, at the executive level, a little different, but let's just talk legislative for a moment. If the party in power is predominantly pro-abortion, as is the case with the Democrat Party, that party is going to squash any attempt to move pro-life legislation forward. So even if there are a handful of pro-life Democrats, they're no good to us because the party they are a member of controls the chamber and will kill any bill that is designed to protect innocent human life. On the other side, you have the Republican Party who, let's be honest, they've not been perfect in their attempts to uphold protections for the unborn, but they're certainly better than those who would promote the destruction of the unborn wholesale. Greg Kokel has a good point. Given a choice between a first-class arsonist or a second-class fireman, you go with the second-class fireman and challenge him to do better. So in that case, if I'm looking at the legislative level, I'm going to vote for the candidate that is a member of the party most likely to advance our cause if that candidate's party were to win control of the chamber. And that, to me, is the big issue.
What is, bottom line, fundamentally wrong with that decision made 41 years ago tomorrow?
There are a handful of issues. The fundamental one, though, is this. It ignored completely the status of the unborn. It pretended, the court pretended, not to answer the question, are the unborn human? but went on to act as if they were not by making abortion legal through all 9 months of pregnancy. So when people say, oh, the court didn't say when life begins, they don't know what they're talking about. Of course the court did. Imagine if the court a century and a half ago were to say, we're going to take no issue on whether the slave is human, but if you want to enslave African Americans, have at it, we're not going to get in the way. That's taking a position that slaves do not have the intrinsic dignity of white people in the same way that the court in Roe has taken the position that the unborn do not have the intrinsic dignity of their mothers and other people. So the court really did take a position. Of course, there's other minor problems. I say minor, they're really big, but compared to that one, they're minor, such as the court's history of abortion law in this nation was horrible, the way it presented that. It was absolutely wrong. It was wrong on other issues as well, but the big one is it ignored the central question, what is the unborn?
Finally, what do you say to someone listening to us right now, and there are those listening to us right now who would say, look, I am personally opposed to abortion. I'd never have one myself or encourage someone else to do it, but I don't think we should legislate against it. What's your response?
I would ask them why they're personally opposed. If abortion does not intentionally kill an innocent human being, why be opposed to it at all? But if it does intentionally kill an innocent human being, then what's wrong with laws protecting innocent human beings? Abraham Lincoln dealt with this when he debated Douglas and others on slavery. And he made the point to Douglas, he says, listen, you can't just say that you think slavery is wrong, but you don't care if a state votes it up or down. You can't argue that way if you think slavery is wrong. You do not have a right to do what is wrong. I mean, imagine me saying, I personally oppose slavery, but if you want to own a slave, do it. Or I personally oppose spousal abuse, but if you want to beat your wife, that's your business. Anybody who heard me say that would instantly grasp that I do not understand the intrinsic evil of both of those behaviors. In the same way, when people tell me they are personally opposed to abortion but want it legal, my first thought is, have they ever seen an abortion? Have they ever gone to a website like ours and viewed a 55-second video that's there that will show them what it is? I don't think these people really believe abortion is wrong. What I think they're trying to do is make themselves feel good by sort of condemning it, but making sure that option is always available should it be needed.
Scott Klusendorf is president of Life Training Institute. He's author of the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. You can find out more about Life Training Institute and Scott's book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Scott, it is always a pleasure. Thank you for all your work, and thanks for being our guest.
Always good to be with you, Todd. I'll let you know, by the way, we're going to be posting tomorrow an interview with John Piper and Francis Chan on the very question of what Christians can do on this issue.
Thank you very much. When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Tom Baker, host of the radio show Law and Gospel. We'll be in Matthew chapter 4, Jesus calling the first of his disciples. Stay tuned. We'll be teaching that Sunday school lesson with Pastor Tom Baker right after this.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The Virtual Organist Service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Grace Lutheran, Henderson, Nevada. Faith Lutheran, Orange City, Iowa. Bethany Lutheran, Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethlehem Lutheran, North Zulch, Texas. Risen Christ Lutheran, Arvada, Colorado. Trinity Lutheran and Grace Lutheran, Wichita, Kansas. Emmanuel Lutheran, Perryville, Missouri. Risen Savior Lutheran, Basar, Kansas. St. John Lutheran, Champaign, Illinois. Trinity Lutheran, Auburn, Nebraska. Holy Trinity Lutheran, Columbia, South Carolina, Grace Lutheran, Elgin, Texas, Gethsemane Lutheran, Marion, Ohio, and St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes a congregational sponsor, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.